Hello and welcome to the Heat Check. My name is Wes Goldberg. Joining me on the other line, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. It's been a good playoff series so far, and I'm eager to break it down and talk about the details that you've noticed for the first two games.
Yeah, the Heat have split the series 1-1 with the Toronto Raptors heading back to Miami for Game 3. I think before the series started, if you would have given Heat fans an opportunity to choose, hey, head back with a 1-1 series lead to Miami going into Game 3, every one of them takes it, right?
Absolutely. But yet there's still that kind of feeling that they squandered an opportunity because of the way they let a big lead in the fourth quarter slip away and then to fall in overtime in Game 2.
Yeah, I think on this podcast we could just kind of talk about our overall thoughts about Games 1 and 2 and just kind of lump them together as the Toronto games. I think one of the things that the Heat did against Charlotte in the last two games, Game 6 and 7 to close out that series, was they took those like 4 and 5 minute stretches of just empty possessions and no points, and kind of, they still had them, but not they weren't so heavy. It was, you know, they took 4 minutes and took it down to 2 minutes, so maybe they go scoreless, but it's only for 2 minutes. And that, even just that helps, because the Heat were up by 6 points in the fourth quarter with about 4 minutes left, and the Raptors came back and scored 10 straight points to make it 84-80. And then there was a couple scores here and there, and then Miami had to use a Dwayne Wade three-pointer and a Goran Dragic three-pointer in order to tie it and force overtime. But, you know, that 10-0 run with 4 minutes left, you just can't do that. And it was about 4 minutes of the Heat just going scoreless. That's tough, and that's especially with so little time left in the game. And then in overtime, they didn't score at all until 30 seconds left in overtime, so another like almost 4 minutes gone by without scoring.
I think Ethan Skolnick tweeted something about this early in the game when it started off particularly sloppy and there was a handful of turnovers in the first few minutes. You know, this was the look of a team that was pretty satisfied with having already split the series. Like they got game one, and so they weren't necessarily as fully engaged during game two. And you could see that right away. I mean, they were, you know, like I said, they were really sloppy, turning the ball over, kind of careless with a number of possessions there. And not till later on that they start playing with an edge and say, you know what, this game is still within our... I guess they were maybe expecting more of a blowback from Toronto. You know, you figure Toronto's won 4 games after they've lost the previous game throughout this playoffs, and you thought that maybe they would be a little bit more active and engaged, and that wasn't the case. I guess Miami realized maybe midway through the game, or maybe even midway through the second half, or first half rather, that this was a game that was still winnable. And so then all of a sudden they started turning it up a notch. They got pretty close. I think they were down what, by 4 or 5 right before the end of the half, and then they finally closed the half down 7. So the game was still, you know, within reach for them. And then in the second half, they were far more efficient, very active, despite the injury concerns and everything else that we'd noticed. That was a different team altogether. But it was just, you know, when they started off, there was a lackadaisical attitude about it. Like, oh, we already got to split. We've already achieved something. So if we don't win game two, it's still all right.
Right. And, you know, they opened that first quarter with 11 turnovers. In that first quarter, I mean, that's just, I mean, the turnover difference alone, you know, we can sparse and analyze and nitpick game two as much as we want, whether or not Miami ran an efficient offense, they got the shots they wanted, if they should have gotten Whiteside involved more, et cetera, et cetera. But they committed 21 turnovers in the game, and Toronto only committed 9. And you're just not going to win a lot of games like that. So for the Heat to even be in that game says something. For that game to even have gone into overtime says something. And I think, you know, obviously I don't expect the Heat to commit so many turnovers. I mean, 11 in one half is a nice little handicap to give yourself going forward, but
in one quarter, you mean?
Yeah, right, in one quarter. And you know, they cleaned it up with only, I think, one turnover in the second quarter, but then they committed 10 turnovers in the second half. So they committed, you know, even without that first quarter, they still committed more turnovers in one half than the Raptors did in an entire game. And you're not going to win playoff games like that, especially by giving Toronto extra possessions, because the Raptors have shown that they're not scoring at will. They're not getting great shots. So to give them so many extra possessions and probably possessions in transition, if you consider a turnover, then, you know, you're just making it easier for them. So I think that the Heat, they cut that down, right? And for them to even have been in that game by after committing so many turnovers is a positive in some weird way.
Yeah, no, I agree there. I mean, the fact was it was still winnable, and you have to take something positive from that. And you did get the split. So, I mean, at the end, you go back to Miami feeling decent about your chances, pretty confident overall, despite the fact that, you know, you could have won game two, even though there were a litany of things that went wrong. They didn't play their best, far from it, and they were still right there within it at you know, with a few seconds left in the game. They could have done it. They fell apart in overtime, but I did see some potential concerns about, you know, the little time in between games two and three. I mean, I know we're probably going to preview the next game a little bit, but, you know, are you concerned at all that maybe with Miami being a little bit older of a team, that maybe they won't be as well rested, and maybe that there's an opportunity there for Toronto to take a game in Miami?
You know, I think that, but I mean, I think we've been concerned with that for the entire season, for the most part, for the Heat. And I think, you know, it's reared its head a couple times with Dwayne Wade and back-to-backs or something like that. But I think as long as they get that at least a day off, even though that they're traveling and all that stuff, yeah. I'm not really that concerned about it.
It didn't play an issue against Charlotte, and that's right. I remember. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, yeah, the Raptors are younger, but they're still dealing with the same amount of days off, so... The good thing about the playoffs is, you know, it's not one team off on the second game of a back-to-back while another team has 2 days rest or something like that. Like, everybody has the same amount of rest, which is nice. So, I think that's something that always favors the Heat in general for the last few years, even during the Big Three era, was that there are no back-to-backs, they get the same amount of rest as the other team, and for the most part, that stuff hasn't really creeped in for the Heat. In recent years, so I'm not that concerned about it. Are you?
No, it's something worth noting. You know, a lot of, I guess, experts, pundits, whatever you want to call them, have pointed to Miami's age and whether or not it's an issue, but something to consider. But no, I feel good about Miami's chances coming back to Miami. They look stronger than Toronto in a lot of ways, and certainly their shooting is significantly better. I don't know if that's sustainable either, you know, that whether or not we expect some bounce back from Lowry and DeRozan. I didn't expect him to be this bad. I know the injury concerns for Lowry were something that we talked about before the series, but now they're just missing a bunch of easy open shots. And I know Miami's defense has a part of that as well, but I didn't expect their shooting to be this bad. And I don't know that they have a chance of winning unless they get a significant turnaround. I know Valanciunas has done a pretty good job of keeping them afloat and you know, being productive for Toronto, but without Lowry and DeRozan, I'm just not sure if they have a chance of winning a game moving forward.
It's been so weird, Lowry and DeRozan. I mean, DeRozan missed those free throws late in the game, and he's one of the better free throw shooters in the league. It's such a mental thing, and it's just, I can't even, it must be unbearable for Raptors fans to even watch it. And for Raptors fans, and we talk about the Heat being, you know, tied 1-1 going back to Miami, I think Raptors fans are at least we won a game given how we played. You know what I mean? Right. So, I wrote about this for today's Fast Break about Kyle Lowry. I think it comes down to even more for a point for DeRozan. He just needs to make shots. That's his job. But for Lowry, he's a point guard, so it's more than just making shots. He needs to set up the offense. He needs to make sure that he's facilitating in the right way. He needs to make sure that he's controlling the pace in the right way. There's so much more involved in his game, and I think in our preview, we talked about, you know, X factors of the series, and I mentioned Dragic versus Lowry and who can kind of, you know, set the tone during the game, and Lowry's just not been able to do it. And I think Dragic has had such a good first two games.
Absolutely.
He's definitely won that matchup, but for Lowry, you know, he's making bad decisions. He's being aggressive with his shot when he doesn't have to. He's rushing his shot because maybe he's getting the yips, and he wants to make sure that if he's going to shoot it, he wants to be open. So every time he gets a little bit of airspace, he'll just put the shot up, and he's kind of off balance on a few shots. And then he'll be like randomly passive. I mean, there's a couple times where he's in the lane and he'll dump it off to Jonas Valanciunas or another player cutting along the baseline or something like that, for even though he's open for the shot that he should probably take. He just seems so unsure about himself, not only shooting, but in his decision making. And as long as he's doing that, and as long as he's doubting himself, the Heat hold a significant advantage in this series, I think.
28%. I mean, if you had told me that Kyle Lowry would go into this series and shoot 28% through first two games, I would not have believed it, considering he's been playing so well throughout most of the year. I know that, again, the injury certainly plays a part, but it's just, it's ugly, isn't it? I mean, he's just putting up these shots. I know you wrote about it, but it's just, it's seeing it, and it's impossible to even picture him playing that badly, but yet there it is.
So there's been a lot of talk, and you and I have talked about it before we started recording, but it's gotten the knack for being an ugly series. People keep calling it quote-unquote ugly. But I think that the defense for both teams should get some credit, right?
I agree. I think, you know, it's just in contrast to the reputation of San Antonio and the explosive ability of Oklahoma City out west. And of course, you've got, you know, potent offense in Dame Lillard and Portland, and of course, the Golden State Warriors. And then you have a historic three-point shooting night in the other Eastern Conference series from the Cleveland Cavaliers. So that when you look at this in comparison to those, it's not quite as electrifying. They're grinding, slug it out, you know, just really slow, methodical, you know, playing of a basketball. And mm-hmm. it's just, it's not exactly as aesthetically pleasing, but, you know, there is something to that. I think people are already dismissing that either Miami or Toronto, whoever advances, won't be able to challenge Cleveland. Maybe that is the case, but you do have to give the defense a little bit of a nod there, and maybe they might be able to slow down the impact that Cleveland has had in the Eastern Conference Finals, whichever team does advance, because I think you're right. They've both teams have adjusted. They haven't been able to play as well as they'd like. You saw Miami capable of being explosive against Charlotte, and I know that Charlotte had a pretty good defense as well. Toronto was a little bit more sluggish when they were facing Indiana. So maybe it's just they've had offensive issues throughout the postseason. But I still think that there's something, I don't know. I personally enjoy it. I don't have a problem with it. You know, just that maybe they're not aesthetically pleasing, but there's still good basketball being played, I think.
Yeah, I mean, both of these teams aren't really, you know, they're not the Warriors and not the Trailblazers or the Spurs, and that they're just going to swing the ball around a bunch of times, pass up good shots for better shots. That's not really how these teams play. And they shouldn't. I mean, I think that whole ball movement thing gets such a good, like, we all get wrapped up in ball movement and that idea of, you know, just swinging the ball back and forth. But the Heat haven't played that way for a lot of times this year. I mean, when Dwayne Wade and Joe Johnson are on the court, they like to get the ball in the post, take two or three dribbles, back down their defender, and that's what they should be doing because they have size advantages over a lot of these guys. Right. It's the way Miami plays. And Toronto, for the most part, is the same way. Lowry's, you know, stronger and more physical than most point guards. DeRozan is the same way. He thrives in the mid-range game, in the mid-post. Valanciunas and Whiteside, you got to get them the ball, and they take a little while, but they get the ball up near the rim. I just think that that's the way that these teams play. Even Demario Carroll and Luol Deng, I mean, they're kind of like these glue guys, but they tend to eke out for little three-pointers in the corner when, after, you know, Lowry and DeRozan or Wade and Johnson, you know, make their way into the post, they can kick it out to them.
It's the knock Oklahoma City gets, right? They don't swing the ball around much because they don't have to. They've got two incredible players in Westbrook and Durant, so that there's no need to swing the ball around as much.
Right, but neither of these teams has, you know, a electrifying player like Westbrook right now, who just, like, is the aesthetically pleasing part of the Thunder, right? Just because he does amazing things on the court. Neither team has that kind of person. So I don't know why it seems like a surprise for some people. That's just the way these teams play. And one thing that I've noticed between the Hornets series and the Raptors series is, and I think Eric Spoelstra should get some credit for this, they were able to run the Hornets off the three-point line really, really well. They're going over screens. They're funneling everything towards Whiteside near the rim. It's been hard on Whiteside, but at the same time, they're living with whatever results it's going to be. And they're doing the same thing against the Raptors. They're running everybody off the three-point line, and they're funneling everything to Whiteside. So yeah, you get some hiccups in the pick and roll, and it's frustrating, especially late in game two, and Whiteside didn't really know how to play the Valanciunas Kyle Lowry pick and roll, and he showed too much hesitation, and Lowry ended up hitting two two-pointers to grab the lead. But Eric Spoelstra has made a decision here that he's going to make these playoff games played within the three-point arc. And he believes that the Heat can beat anybody, or it can beat, you know, these teams, as long as it's played within their realm below the three-point arc. So I think that's pretty interesting. That's going to lead to dirty, ugly offensive play. He's just going to force everything inside, and he says, okay, we'll live with some pick-and-roll hiccups, we'll live with some of this stuff, but for 48 minutes, our guys can beat you guys in game, in like a two-pointer game within 18 feet.
And that plays to their strengths. Miami's not exactly a good three-point shooting team, despite the unexpected heroics of Dwayne Wade. They're not exactly enough for their three-point shooting, and so it definitely plays to their strengths. And if you can control the pace, the tempo, and play the series the way you want it to, I think that certainly speaks to Spoelstra's ability to coach the team and control the overall series. So, you know, for all the crap he's gone for not making the right rotations or, you know, putting the right players in, et cetera, the Fire Spo crowd is still fairly active. I think it does show that he's got a good grip of how to handle Toronto. And not to say that Dwayne Casey hasn't made some good adjustments. You pointed out before we got onto the podcast that the use of Damari Carroll was something that stood out to you as well.
Yeah, I mean, you slide Damari Carroll down to the four position. It's pretty interesting that, you know, the Hornets forced seven games with the Heat by putting Al Jefferson and Frank Kaminsky in the starting lineup and trying to, you know, outsize the Heat. And Casey does the exact opposite. He actually, he shifts down his lineup by putting Damari Carroll, switching him from the three, sliding him down to the four. I thought that was pretty interesting in game one. You know, I'm sure you study all the game film and you look at the Hornets and you say, wow, they had a lot of success against the Heat by putting, you know, bigger guys up against them, but made a decision to do the exact opposite and felt that his team had a better advantage that way. And a lot of people are wondering, like, you know, I had a conversation on Twitter earlier today, why aren't the Heat doing that, you know, screening with their perimeter guys as much? You know, we saw a lot of Dragic and Joe Johnson screens, like Dragic setting screens for Joe Johnson late in that Charlotte series, and it was a good play for them. They were getting a lot of open looks that way. Dragic was getting a lot of three-pointers that way, but...
It's happened in this series, but not as frequently, you think?
Yeah, it's definitely happened, but not so much. And a lot of what I've noticed... Dragic does this weird thing, by the way, just to sidetrack for a second. Okay. He'll pass the ball to a player and then immediately ask for it back just to do a weird reset. You've noticed this?
Yeah, but I'm wondering sometimes whether or not he asks for it back or whether or not the player just says, I don't want it, you know, take it back. I'm not sure because you can't – I haven't seen Dragic actually ask for it back. It makes sense that he would be, but I haven't – it's been peculiar to see him pass it off to, you know, Deng or something like that and all of a sudden get the ball right back. It's like –
Well, because he'll give it up and then he'll like stare at him and then they'll give it back. Like if you give the ball up and you don't expect it back, you do some sort of off motion cut or something like that.
It's possible.
But he's also give it back.
He's really good at finding seams and creating space there because he has a quick adjustment as far as his speed is concerned, like where he shifts it into another gear and all of a sudden he finds an opening. He curls around the hoop and into the painted area and all of a sudden he finds an open shot there, or he can up fake somebody into committing the foul or something like that. He's been very consistent with that, and
that's why I think he does it. I think you're right. Like he passes it to the left or the right to one of his perimeter guys. His defender just enough of a takes a step there to the left or the right just to adjust, and then gets it back, and then just tries to blow by him. I think you're right.
Can I voice another concern then?
Sure.
What is with all the goddamn shots of Jurassic Park? I mean, I thought. Am I the only one?
No, you're right. It's like every time something good happens, they do the shot and then they do the shot of out front. You're talking about like the out front park, right?
Yes. In front of the Toronto Arena. It's like, we get it. There's 15,000 people who couldn't afford tickets standing up front of the arena. Great for them. But, you know, you guys are on a 6-0 run. That doesn't necessarily mean you get to cheer for everything that goes on. It's going to be a long 2 hours. If they don't pan to them when they're down 7 at the end of the fourth quarter, I know, you know, it's like, let's be a little bit more even in our shots of Jurassic Park. And maybe, you know, maybe it's the whole thing about creating this narrative of what a great fan base Toronto has.
Right, but even though they left with 2 minutes left in game one.
Yeah,
Kyle Lowry hit probably one of the greatest buzzer beaters in a round two series ever, and you know there's like four people there to see it.
But you know, a lot of it's going to feed the narrative again once the series shifts back to Miami on Saturday. You know, it's like, oh, the fans in Miami don't really care. They don't have a Jurassic Park to pan to. It's going to be like five people outside the arena smoking cigarettes or something like that. It's not exactly the same atmosphere, but that's because downtown Miami is not a safe place for pedestrians. So you can't just stand outside. Although I remember during the finals, there was like a parking lot that was converted for like fans to congregate and stuff like that. Certainly not the same kind of extent as Jurassic Park. And I know whenever, you know, I'm a big Fish fan. Whenever Fish plays in the American Airlines Arena, you know, that whole area in front of the arena becomes like the Fish Village, you know, Shakedown Street, so that all the hippies can set up and sell their wares and food and, you know, other things that you consume before going into a Fish concert. But it's not quite the same atmosphere as Jurassic Park. But I'm just voicing my concerns. I'm a little sick of it. You know, there was one particular moment there in the second half where they were making a run, and it was like every 30 seconds panning over the same crowd there. I was just like, all right, we get it. There are people outside. They're still outside. Big effing deal.
And so who did we get broadcasting the game? Game one, was it Iron Eagle and
Bones? Yeah.
And Bones. That was good. So the Heat win. And then, of course, once Rick Barry is the color commentator, they lose.
John Barry.
Sorry. Either way, they would have lost.
Rick Barry, yeah. Why doesn't Whiteside, you know, he's got that little jump shot. Why doesn't he shoot at underhand free throws? All right, Rick, we get it.
So, yeah, John Barry, nobody likes him. And he's always been bad luck for the Heat. I don't know if the Heat have ever won a game with John Barry calling the game. I want to see the stats on that.
You're right, but at the same time, I feel like he was being very... like he wasn't as negative about Miami as he has been in the past.
He's not as negative now that LeBron's not there.
Oh, is that it? Because you know, I know I've heard him say on air before that, you know, he gets a lot of flack from Heat fans that he hates the team, etc. And then I think he's kind of, you know, curbed it a little bit. And he seems like he was almost complimentary. Certainly was of Dwayne Wade. Whenever Dwayne Wade was hitting a shot, he was like, "Oh, the greatness of Wade showing up, etc." I mean, that was great. But I think if the you know, the number one team for ABC does Saturday's game, Mike Breen, Jeff Van Gundy, and Mark Jackson.
Yeah, we get Mark Jackson coming back. Oh, he's going to be awful. DeRozan shooting from 19 feet. You live with that. If he makes it, you live with it. Dwayne Wade shooting threes. If he makes that, you live with it. There's just going to be a bunch of that.
Yeah.
It's not going
to
be good.
But still, what we tend to win with, I think with the number one team, I think we tend to win. Or maybe I'm just thinking of all those times that Miami was in the finals and they won with...
No, I think you're right. I think Mark Jackson's just, like, you know, grating to listen to. But Jeff Van Gundy's still my favorite. I love him. Not my favorite. He's, like, top three. I got Van Gundy, Doris Burke, and Hubie Brown.
Now, neither of us live in Miami, so is Fox Sports or Sun Sports, whatever, are they still broadcasting games in South Florida?
No, I think they get...
It's all national television.
It's all national now. After round one, it's all national, which kind of sucks. I feel that's kind of rough on the local broadcast crew that they don't get to call those games.
Yeah, does Tony Fiorentino get banned from the arena at this point now?
They're not even allowed in. I wonder if they're even in as media. I don't even know how that works.
I wouldn't think so.
No, they're probably just watching the game on their couch.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think... Eric Reed, he kind of joins the radio broadcast because he's such a familiar voice. So he might replace John Crotty,
right,
on the radio play-by-play. Although I did see Crotty in the Toronto broadcasting row there, so I think he's media row. So I think he's still covering the games. But I know in the past they've brought Eric Reed on board, but I don't know if that's like maybe I guess they can't go through a three-man booth. That's a little excessive, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. It would be actually interesting to hear Eric Reed as a color guy, kind of just get his opinion.
Well, he used to. His first year, I think he did color.
Right. Be nice to go back to that. I mean, not really, because I don't know who the play-by-play guy would be, but I don't know. And no Jason Jackson, which is my least favorite part. I'd rather have Jason Jackson on the sidelines.
J-Jax is the best.
Yeah, he is. Shouts to J-Jax. Why don't we look ahead to Game 3?
All right.
Any concerns that you really have after those two games, other than turnovers, I guess?
I think, well, yeah, obviously. You know, not necessarily a huge concern, but you want them to be well-rested. You want them to be fully engaged. You can't afford to miss any opportunities like they did in Game 2. I'm seeing a lot of people think that Valanciunas is dominating the matchup in the middle. And for whatever reason, I know that maybe I'm prejudiced because I wrote that piece before the series started where I was convinced that Whiteside was going to dominate. And certainly, statistically speaking, Valanciunas has had bigger numbers than Whiteside. But in a direct head-to-head matchup, I don't see Valanciunas being able to dominate Whiteside. Maybe I know he has gone some points against him. I think they've gone at each other. It's fairly even, I think. Although
I
there are
agree.
times when Jonas is able to slip away from Whiteside, particularly in pick and roll situations, or he certainly took advantage of Whiteside's absence when he was hurt in game one. But I'd like to see him kind of shut down a little bit more. I don't want to see. I know some people really dislike Valanciunas. I think somebody tweeted out that Valanciunas has the most punchable face in all of Toronto's roster. I don't
Disagree.
just. You disagree? Who would you say is the most punchable? That's a tough one.
Pretty
Although
tough.
not like Charlotte. Not like Charlotte, right? I mean,
No,
Charlotte.
Charlotte is just a team of punchable faces. Just take your pick. I mean, I think Jeremy Lin starts at the top and then you just work your way
Sure.
down. Frank Kaminsky, even Al
Oh,
Jefferson.
Frank looks like he's lost out there. I feel kind of bad for him.
Kaminsky?
Yeah, he did, right? I mean,
Yeah.
there's just something about his goofy, sleepy-looking face that you kind of think, oh,
Well, it's
poor
typical
kid.
like Midwestern fashion. You leave the land that you grew up in and ate corn in every night for dinner, and you go to a seaboard
It's not three
state.
meals a day. I think it's breakfast, lunch, and dinner, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Just corn for all meals. This is like,
It's,
is there
yeah,
other food out there? I don't even know. Goes
cream
to.
of corn for breakfast, and then you have a corn souffle for lunch, and maybe cornbread for dinner to change it up a little.
And then somebody asks him, "Hey, do you want a piece of baklava or something?" When he's in Charlotte and some hipster Mediterranean place, what the hell are you talking about? What's baklava? I don't want that. Where'd I go? Let's see. It's too bad Louis Scola has such a reputation for being like one of the best teammates in the NBA. Because I could punch him.
I've ignored that because I still think of him from the Indiana Pacers from that time when they were competing against Miami in the Eastern Conference. So to me, he's still punchable, I think,
I think
despite the reputation.
DeRozan has a pretty punchable face.
Oh, I don't know.
No?
No, not to me. Like he just looks more like Valanciunas talks a lot. He's always just like hanging out. He I don't know, something about his size, like he feels a little bit too full of himself. And conversely, Toronto fans, and I'm noticing this, they dislike Hassan Whiteside. They think that this whole Miami team needs to get punched across the face. There was one play there in particular where Valanciunas tried to go at Whiteside, and he made a series of moves down on the block. Whiteside stood his ground. Valanciunas kind of flopped around a little bit, and then he wound up passing the ball or putting up a bad shot that didn't fall. And then Whiteside's jogging down court, and he's got like this grin on his face, like, what the hell was that flop? And somebody tweeted out, somebody needs to punch that grin off Whiteside's face. And to me, I'm thinking it's like he's laughing it off because here's this 7 foot 2, bearded, huge monstrosity of a person kind of trying to draw the foul call by flopping. It's like, dude, you're too big to flop. You can't afford to get away with stuff like that. Go hard or go home, as far as I'm concerned.
Whiteside's pretty polarizing, huh? I mean, even with the Heat fan base, I could see people wanting to punch Whiteside. I could also see, people wanting to punch Dragic for whatever reason. I mean, I think
I can't see.
Europeans have a reputation for people wanting to punch them, so.
His teeth went through his lower lip. I
I
mean,
know.
that's.
How unbelievable is he? And did you see the video? He immediately looked up to where the ball went.
I did not.
So if you watch the video in slow motion of when he gets elbowed, DeMar DeRozan, right? Elbows him.
Yes.
And so he goes down hard, obviously, flies backwards, immediately grabs his lip, but then also rolls over and looks to where the ball went. I mean, the guy is just so in the zone. The last time he almost got knocked out, his tooth fell out and he just kept playing, right? He just threw the tooth for the sideline. It's like, take care of this.
Yes, hang on to it for me. I'll be back in a few minutes to collect my tooth.
Right. I mean, the guy looked to see where the ball went after he his like you said, his tooth went through his face. Like,
And then he got up into Ken Maurer to say, "How are you calling the foul on me? I am bleeding. There is a hole where my face used to be. Come on, guy. And this is Ken Maurer of the guy who missed at least five foul calls at the end of the Oklahoma City
yes, had no
San
idea what to
Antonio
do.
game. Yeah, who quite literally said, "We've never seen this before. We don't know how to call it." he's officiating a playoff game 2 days later. Not exactly a good look for the NBA referees, as far as I'm concerned.
Nope. Now the playoff officiating has been too much of a story, but that's a whole other podcast. But
yeah, you never want to put too much stock in it. But you know, on a series of plays, it was that brutal second quarter, right, where Valanciunas accidentally rolls all 300 pounds of him onto Dwayne Wade's knee and ankle, right.
Or even the end of game one where Lowry was probably out of bounds before he shot that half court heave miracle.
Okay, you know, I haven't seen enough made about that because everybody's just like so desperate to say finally Lowry hits a shot. But
it's that and the Heat ended up winning. Right. If the Heat would have lost, I think a lot more would have been made out of it. But I agree, there should have been more. Like, the fact that they didn't even get a review. I mean, Spoelstra just said afterwards he didn't ask for the review. He wanted to get his team in a huddle right away. But, I don't know. I feel like the refs should have reviewed that on, you know, it took it onto themselves to review it. They shouldn't have, you know, waited for Spoelstra to ask for a review. Because they can review it by themselves, right? They can just say, hey, we need to review that.
And I want to implore all of Heat Twitter to not complain too much more about the officiating. It's not going to make any goddamn difference one way or the other. Yeah. But I understand the frustration. There have been some, especially like I said, that second quarter where Whiteside, Dragic, and Wade all get hurt by a number of fouls. And for Dragic to not even get the call, I mean, he took a charge, clearly a charge. He took an elbow right in the face. He gets up to show the blood to Ken Maurer. It's like, look, I am bleeding. Clearly there was contact there. Can you just give me the foul call? I mean, that is a little frustrating. I can just imagine. And well, you know what? Maybe it worked. Like, we'd always talked during the Big Three era that Dwayne Wade and LeBron always played a little better when they were pissed off. Maybe it works for Goran as well.
He's just a monster. I can't believe that he just keep, like, and he gets eight stitches and comes back and plays, and he plays well and hits a three-pointer to tie the game and force overtime. I mean,
I loved it as he was, like, running off the court at one point and the bandage is, like, flapping off of his face. And he's just, like, he doesn't even care. He's all psyched up because he made his big shot. That was amazing.
And the video, I mean, after he lost his tooth, the video after the game, I think the Palm Beach Post posted it, Jason Leisure.
Yeah.
Posted it, and he's just like laughing about his tooth, and he shows the reporters he's got a tooth in a little bag or a little like little bottle thing, and he's just like laughing it off. He thinks it's like the funniest thing in the world, and it's just the guy is amazing. I mean, if he hasn't endeared himself to Heat fans by now, who were like asking for Mario Chalmers to start over him at the beginning of the season. And Mario Chalmers, RIP, greatest of all time.
And we were going to package him and Whiteside to Houston for Dwight Howard.
Oh, right. I remember that. Well. So I think Dragic has earned his keep by now.
I would say so.
So game three preview. One thing I'm interested in seeing is now that they're playing at home, do they quicken the pace a little bit more? Do they try to get out and transition a little bit more? Because we really haven't seen that killer Heat transition game since, I think, game five of Charlotte. And I think you give credit to Charlotte in those last two games and then Toronto in these first two games of you know, being prepared for Miami trying to get a rebound and push the ball down the court with either Luol Deng bringing the ball or Winslow bringing up the ball or whatever. You know, these teams are getting ahead of that, and they're getting set in their half-court defense pretty quickly. But I do wonder, I think there were opportunities there in game two to take advantage of but Miami slowed it down. I'd be interested to see if they try to get some more easy points in transition. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, and I think another issue is also trying to get Hassan Whiteside involved more.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
If Valanciunas is going to continue to be a problem, you probably want to try and go at him a little bit more actively, either through pick and roll situations where you might be able to draw the foul if the officiating swings your way, or with Whiteside just going directly one-on-one with him and seeing if he can draw the foul there. It's just, I think partly it's not Whiteside's makeup to complain for fouls after the fact maybe, but not to sell contact enough. He just kind of absorbs his contact and tries to finish through, unlike Valanciunas, who will obviously sell the contact and try to draw the foul that way. But I think it's imperative for Whiteside to try and go a little bit more actively at him.
Yeah, and to go back to that Whiteside versus Valanciunas conversation, Whiteside's got to box out Valanciunas a little bit better. Valanciunas got a couple offensive rebounds late in that game, and Whiteside needs to be more concerned about that, about boxing out and just making sure that Valanciunas doesn't get to... I mean, he's a rebounding machine just like Whiteside is. I mean, Whiteside can't rely on just his sheer size and athleticism anymore.
Is it just a lapse of judgment, or he's not in the moment,
I
or
think
is
it's
he?
just a lack of, yeah, I think it's a lack of focus. I think, or really, like, Whiteside doesn't box out really. I mean, he does, but not, he doesn't. That's not really what he, it's not how he relies on to get
You're
rebounds.
right.
It's not what he does. So I think just
Oh.
too often he just relies on his just size and athleticism and jumping ability to just go be taller and bigger and faster than everybody else. And he can't do that against Valanciunas.
Shout out to Udonis Haslem, right? I mean, I think
Yeah.
he's been playing some pretty solid minutes overall.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see if Mick Roberts gets some play in Miami.
Yeah, it's interesting though, right? If they quicken the pace, you'd think that would lend itself more to McRoberts' skill set. But
Yeah.
it's funny that you know, Haslem didn't play much against Charlotte until, in Spoelstra's words, you know, the series got to be a little bit medieval, and
Yep.
so he required Udonis to play a little bit. But he's gone to him the first two games of the Toronto series. He's already played more minutes than I think he played in all of the Charlotte series. So he's been a factor. He's rebounding. He hit his first shot. That was nice to see. And I know some people have tweeted about this before, and it still rings true. If you could somehow take Udonis's passion and intensity and put it into a Whiteside's incredible body, you'd probably have the best center in NBA history.
I don't disagree with that, and but you know, Haslam had to rely on that. You wrote a great piece for Vice on Haslam. He had to
Thank you.
he you're welcome. He had to rely on that to get even back into the or get into the NBA, and you know, Whiteside has been so much bigger and faster and stronger than other people that he doesn't have to really be that have that kind of personality to keep a spot in the NBA. I don't think there's any doubt that he works hard, but he's still really raw. I mean, he's got happy feet. He doesn't really know. He doesn't have great footwork at this level yet. He relies a lot on his athleticism, but that's fine. Like he really like it's ha hasn't even been 2 seasons that he's been an NBA player really. So I think we gotta give him a break a little bit. But at the same time, if you're Mickey Arison, if you're Pat Riley, you're looking at Whiteside thinking right now that he needs to step up, and he needs to be able to outplay Valanciunas, who's also very raw. He needs to be able to outplay Valanciunas right now if he wants a max contract for the Heat or something near it, or it'll make
Right.
their decision a lot easier if Whiteside outplays Valanciunas. But if he plays him to a draw and doesn't outplay him in crunch time right now like he has in the last two games, that's going to make that decision way harder. Not to look too forward, but that's going to make that decision much more difficult.
I agree.
But yeah, I think you're right. Get Whiteside more involved. Get him some more touches in pick and roll situations. His mid-range game has been off in the playoffs. His hands aren't. I mean, he isn't like just grabbing everything with those super glue hands that he was in the regular season. Have you noticed that? That he's just dropping more things. He's dropping more passes. Dropping more loose balls. More rebounds.
Yeah. I think that's been like all season long. Remember last year, I mean, you and I used to talk about it frequently last year, that it was just like, if you toss it anywhere near Whiteside, he's going to catch it and he's going to lock onto it and he's not going to let go. I guess he's trying to have a little bit of a softer touch around the basket. And so his hands might not be, maybe he's not, I don't know, maybe he's not squeezing his hands as much. I honestly couldn't tell you what
Seems
the reason
weird.
Is. It does, right? Like he's dropped passes or he's fighting. I mean, I think at one point Kyle Lowry ripped a rebound out of his hands. It's like, these things shouldn't happen when you're the size and strength of a guy like Hassan Whiteside.
Yeah, and you know, there was one play at the end of that Raptors game where I can't remember who, but knocked it back in bounds, and Whiteside basically stepped right in front of it and could have had a transition opportunity, because I guess the rest of the Heat players were starting to dart down the court, and Whiteside could have had a little bit of an outlet pass and gotten the Heat some easy points, but basically just dropped the ball, and then that's when it got called for a jump ball with Valanciunas. But you know what I'm talking about? Like, that was weird. That was a weird play. Like,
Yeah.
Whiteside usually just holds on to that ball. So I think that finishing more near the rim, I just think he's been and maybe even hitting some more mid-range jumpers just to give a little bit of a different flavor to the Heat's offense. I know I've written about that mid-range jumper being fool's gold
Yeah,
for
I
the
don't know if
Heat.
I want him to take that shot.
Yeah, but you know, if he's gonna take it, at least make it. You know, at the rate he was making it before, when you have a grinded out series like it is, you just kind of take the shots that you can be that you get. So, I think any other concerns would be, I wonder if The Raptors switched up their defense a couple times in game two. They were switching everything in that first half. And I think for the first three quarters, they were switching everything, which is why I think they downshifted with Damari Carroll at the four. They're switching everything along the perimeter. And they stopped doing that in the fourth quarter when they made that 10-0 run. Mm-hmm. They just played them. They played the Heat head, you know, face up against on position. But I wonder if they'll do that in game three. And if they do stop switching in game three, you wonder if they insert Patrick Patterson back into that starting lineup, move Carroll back to the three, or bring him off the bench. Because if you're not switching everything, having a bunch of perimeter players doesn't make as much sense. You know, yeah,
I'm surprised that they've gone with Norm Powell. I mean, he's just not much of a factor at this point, considering that he played such a huge role in being able to guard, you know, Paul George in the Indiana series. He just hasn't been much of a factor. I think Dwayne Wade has somehow managed to use his veteran savvy to minimize his impact.
Mm-hmm. Wade's been terrific. I mean, he's been absolutely great in the pick and roll and everything like that. And if Whiteside, again, not to harp on Whiteside, but if he gets going in that pick and roll, the Heat can win games with Whiteside and Wade. I don't know. It's been an evenly played series, and it'll just be interesting to see if both of these teams kind of clean things up. I think the one elephant in the room is if Lowry and DeRozan get going, that puts a whole big, wrench in the Heat's plans, and that might force an adjustment from Miami to play a little bit of different defense on DeRozan or Lowry.
Mm-hmm.
I think we covered pretty much everything for game three.
Well, I know that we'll be taking a short break, and then later on in the show, we will be hosting Josh Eberle of NBA's Hoop Mag, who mm-hmm. will have a different perspective on the series. I think he's based in Canada.
Yeah, he lives in Canada.
Yeah, so that's an interesting take. We'll hope to hear from him. And
wonder what he thinks of Jurassic Park.
Yeah, he might be there.
He might be at Jurassic Park.
Yeah, he might be one of those guys that's there cheering during that 6-0 run.
the big old 6-0 run, yep. All right, yeah, we'll be back a little bit later with Josh Eberle. And until then, thanks for listening to the Heat Check Podcast. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it.
I don't think there's anything I could do. I think if Dwayne Wade gave me a rosary, it wouldn't help at this point.
The thing with Heat Twitter is, even if you're like slightly critical of Whiteside, then it's like Heat Twitter is like the meanest to Hassan Whiteside, but as soon as like somebody else off Heat Twitter criticizes Whiteside, they just like, they blacklist them. It's crazy. Like, Heat Twitter hates Nate Duncan. They're almost ready to blacklist Zach Lowe. Like, it's bad. Not my favorite Twitter to be a part of.
It's so weird, man. I think I've had crazy stuff said to me on Twitter over the years, but I think I've blocked like 18 people maybe in Twitter land ever, and I think 15 of them must be fans. Like, unbelievable. They it's come like, for blood.
They get such a bad rap, but like, understandably, like, they're so hostile. I think it all comes from like the Big Three era, when like everybody just shit on them and like made the Heat the enemies, and like, they've just like, it wasn't like that before, and then I don't know, it just like grew as this like hostile environment. It's like, it's crazy.
It's hysterical, man. I mean, we can talk about it when we're rolling, even if you want, but
yeah, I'm actually rolling right now because I just hit record as soon as the call starts, so whatever.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, it's crazy because I actually really like Hassan Whiteside. Like, I'm a big fan of his. I got killed by a lot of casual NBA fans when I said I thought he was better than Andre Drummond. And it's actually, I think it's the Wade criticism, and it's not even criticism. It's like stuff like, oh, is he going to be able to be healthy, or are we sure he's going to make it all the way to June and stuff like, just like simple questions that people were like, you fatherless F, how could you ever say that about Dwayne Wade? And it spirals, man. It just spirals. Like,
the thing, like, they're hostile with each other too. Like, they just fight amongst. I keep saying they. I'm like kind of a part of it, just because like I don't know. I try to like stay above it a little bit. I try not to like dabble too much into the dirtiness of it. But it's just amongst itself. I don't know. Like, I'm not. I guess I'm not like on a lot. I'm not like really ingrained in any other team Twitters. Is it like? I know like Knicks Twitter is supposed to be really good. Like what? Like is there a Raptors Twitter?
There, you know what? There is a Raptors Twitter, but like Raptors Twitter is like a lot of bloggers and people just coming to the sport. I think for the Raptors, like, not that there isn't a good fan base there, it is, but they haven't had a lot to talk about prior to the last couple of years. Whereas, like, Heat Twitter, like you said, when the big three got together, and I didn't make the mistake, I didn't realize quite the extent to which they felt persecuted, I guess, during that era due to the LeBron decision and the built, not bought, or whatever, or bought, not built. But I remember people saying they understood why LeBron went down to Miami because he's in this with this Cleveland team that has no chance to win. And I was on that side of the fence, and I said that on Twitter. And they're like, no, no one liked us. No one ever cared about us. We're Orphan Annie. Don't ever say otherwise. And it's like, okay, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, they're just there's like a lot of like anger like bubbling up, just ready to come out like at any moment. It's like a volcano. It's wild, and they just like it's ruthless. So I don't know. I could talk about the magic of Heat Twitter all day. I'm glad to be somewhat of a part of it and just kind of join in on the fun every once in a while. But yeah, I think like the whole victim thing is getting kind of old.
And I mean, the Heat are a competitive team without LeBron James. Like, they don't have to lick all the wounds. And there's this whole movement I keep seeing, like, Heat gone and, like, all these Heat. They hate – I don't understand how you can, like, hate LeBron James at the same time and then be hoping that he's leaving Cleveland this season to come back. It's like – it is the scorned lover situation. And I don't know. It's overplayed.
Yeah. So you're in Canada. Are you – you grew up a Raptors fan, or am I assuming that?
No, actually, I'm a Dallas fan. Okay. If I'm being really honest, I'm a Dallas Mavericks fan. But as a Canadian who's always loved basketball, who's always had to sit through 25 minutes of hockey, football, and baseball highlights.
Is that because of Steve Nash, by the way?
Sorry?
Is it because of Steve Nash? I'm just like...
Actually, no. my mom was a flight attendant when I was growing up, and she just went to Dallas and brought me home a Cowboys shirt and a Mavericks shirt when I was like 5 years old. So that's the first two teams I knew of.
That'll do it.
I was at a
carnival once, and I won like a Charlotte Hornets basketball. It was like a plush basketball that I won, and I always had like a soft spot in my heart for the Hornets growing up. Even though I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, South Florida, and so I've always been a Heat fan. But all of that went out the window in that first round series because now I hate the Hornets.
Yeah. With the Cowboys, there's no other team that I really entertain, but with basketball, I just love the NBA. And in Canada, I mean, basketball was such a low priority for so long. I wasn't a fan of the Raptors. I was a fan of what the Raptors winning could do for basketball fandom in Canada. I think that's still kind of where I'm at.
So David Ramil and I recorded the other part of the podcast. I don't know if it's good. I don't know. I might make this a separate podcast depending on how long this goes or whatever. If it can, I don't know. I'm not sure yet, but basically we were talking about Jurassic Park, that whole outdoor area with the Raptors. Like the thing that ABC and ESPN keeps panning to like every time something good for the Raptors happens, and we're finding it kind of annoying, but, what do you think about that Jurassic Park thing? Is the Raptors fandom like at an all time high right now? I mean, I imagine Vince Carter started it and everything like that, but what's kind of like the vibe around the Raptors right now?
Well, like I'm in Calgary, right? So I'm a ways away from Toronto. I honestly what was that 2013 when the Raptors played Brooklyn in the first round? Do I got my years right here? Then when they played Brooklyn, they went to Game 7. And this is a story I always tell people. It's Game 7, and I'm in the Calgary airport. I'm about to catch a flight. And there's like a little Chili's. It's like a little bar. There's not even a restaurant. There's like two tables, and you kind of order your drink at the Chili's or whatever and walk around. There's got to be 300 people packed in around this Chili's just watching this Raptors game. And I have never, ever seen anything like that before. I mean, prior to that, when I went to the bar to watch a game or whatever the hockey would be on, and I'd be hard pressed to get the bartender to throw the basketball game on a TV. It was really, really cool when that team was first, that was the Lowry DeRozan team, the first year they really made some noise. in that game seven. Everybody watched. I mean, Lowry misses that shot and they lose the game, but just to see Canadians really be into it, I think that's when it started to really perk up. And then, honestly, the We the North marketing campaign really did wonders. It made it cool to be a Raptors fan. It kind of took away from, I think before it was always Toronto, but they really targeted a lot of other Canadians. I don't know if it's at an all-time high, but it's definitely rising, and I think this first-round victory really helps. That being said, Lowry and DeRozan's struggles aren't doing them any favors, especially in a game like basketball where a star is just so polarizing. Everybody wants Lowry or DeRozan to be the guy, and neither of them has really been anything to write positively about, and that hurts.
So what do you think it is with Lowry? Because everybody keeps talking about his elbow, his mental state. I mean, obviously he's better than this.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing with Lowry and Zubo, I don't know how bad it was. It is. It was the same situation last year where he's kind of hurt in the playoffs. He gimped the last little bit of the season, and they limped out. But whether it's his elbow or not, he's choosing to play. He's on the court. It's not an injury that's holding him out. And I don't want to be harsh or anything, but I don't really care. I don't think anyone should care. If you're playing in the playoffs, you got to play. And he hasn't been playing well. And I mean, to Lowry, to some extent, his shooting has been bad, but he does other things. Like, he passes the ball. He gets a lot of assists. He'll rebound. He'll make steals. He competes defensively. DeRozan, on the other hand, yeah, maybe his thumb's a little tweaked, but his shooting has been terrible. And DeRozan's shot's not going down. And when he can't hit free throws 2 of 8 the other night, he doesn't bring anything else to this team.
So you and I both write for today's Fast Break, and I actually wrote a piece about Kyle Lowry after Game 1. And it's basically saying the same exact thing you're saying. I mean, all of the attention is on how he can't make a shot, but like I said, he's playing. He can still hoist the ball near the basket. It's just not going in. And he's making like bad basketball decisions. Like, he'll rush wide open shots, or even worse, rush contested shots and not get a good base on a shot, and or then passively give away like an open shot for like a in a pick and roll to like Valanciunas for like no reason, who's like covered by Whiteside, and like he just keeps making the wrong basketball decisions. So it's more than just not making shots. He's just not doing the other thing the point guards do. Like, it's one thing if DeMar DeRozan is struggling, because when it comes down to it, he just needs to shoot. But Kyle Lowry means so much more to the Raptors and everything else that he does. So if he's struggling from front to back of his game, I just don't see a way that the Raptors win this series, even though it's 1-1 right now.
You know, I can't disagree. It's 1-1. I said this on Twitter. If you're a Toronto fan, you don't lose any sleep about going to Miami. I mean, you've played lackluster in the playoffs at home, away. It doesn't matter. This team has played how they've played. That being said, something's got to change. I mean, you can't continue to get by. I mean, Corey Joseph's giving you all these shots. Patrick Patterson, Norman Powell. You're getting contributions from guys that aren't supposed to be carrying you. But if your all-star backcourt, I mean, the two guys that carry you all year that your offense is based around don't turn around, there's no chance. And the thing with the Raptors, too, is they have Jonas Valanciunas. They don't use him. They've never used him. I mean, in this season, in this series so far, in two games, he's averaging like almost, 2013, 2012 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's a fantastic player. He finishes. He's proven that he can get to the rim, finish at a high rate, but they just don't feed him the ball. And they haven't done that. And they didn't do that against Brooklyn in the past. They didn't do it against the Wizards. I don't want to blame Casey and mismanagement, and I don't want to put it all on mental or injuries, but there just seems to be a lot of things holding this team back from reaching its true potential.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Dwayne Casey's? Because I thought this was interesting. Obviously, he scouts the Heat in that first round series against the Hornets, and the Hornets made that they won 3 straight games to make it a series by going big. Al Jefferson, Frank Kaminsky in the front court. That's what made them successful, by walling off the paint to Miami's guards to get into the paint. Miami has taken its guards to the paint and in the mid post already in this series. I found it interesting that instead of maybe using Patrick Patterson and Valanciunas like he had to end that Pacers series, which I thought was going to cause the Heat problems, he downshifted, put Damari Carroll at the 4, and basically did the opposite of what the Hornets did in order to make it a competitive series. I mean, what did you make of that decision?
I liked it at first because I think Luol Deng just absolutely torched the Hornets in a few of those games.
Yeah.
And you didn't want to have him running around with a big guy chasing him, can't catch up to him, can't get through screens, etc. And I mean, I see what you're saying, but Luis Scola needed to be out of the rotation. He wasn't adding much. You can't really play Biombo and Valanciunas together. Just too clogged. And I mean, Carroll's played well to this point. So he's kind of stuck. I mean, the Raptors are in a weird – they don't have a traditional power forward. They don't have a guy at the four. They really want to play 30-plus minutes a night. And that was what they were supposed – that was the talk at the deadline, right, was that they were going to add somebody else in there and they didn't get it done, and that might bite them.
So what do you think that they should do now? I mean, the Raptors' offense hasn't been good. The Heat's offense really hasn't been as efficient, but I think they're getting the shots that they want. Do you think either of these teams make a major adjustment?
I think Toronto should. I mean, Casey said in the Pacers series that he's going to live or die with Lowry and DeRozan. But what DeRozan's doing is obviously mental. You don't shoot 2 of 8 from the free throw. Like, his name isn't Andre DeRozan. This isn't Dwight DeRozan. This is DeMar DeRozan. All year he was consistent. He got to the line. He knocked down his free throws. He's never been a great jump shooter, but his confidence is just so shot. And I hate talking about the mental aspect of the game because more than anything, you're reaching as an analyst. We don't know what's going on in his head. We don't know what pressure's on behind him. But there's something wrong here. He just – you can't go from being an all-star player to where everyone in the league was like, wow, DeRozan's really come into his own. He's totally earned himself a max contract. He might be, you know, the third or fourth best shooting guard in the league to this. I mean, he is a handicap right now. So if I was Dwayne Casey, I'd give them one more game. You know, I'd give them one more game in Miami, shake it off, have a flight. You got this win, as terrible as that win was. You're going to Miami 1-1. You hope that they get it together game 3. You play your guys because you said you wanted to support them. But if you get another game like this, and the only reason, like neither Toronto or Miami has been excellent in the series, but if Miami figures out the turnovers, they win both these games, no problem. If DeRozan dogs it again in game 3, I think you have to switch it up. And I'm not talking about, you know, throwing in Powell to the lineup to switch it up or Patterson or whatever. I'm thinking you got to bench DeRozan. And I know they don't want to do that, and I know that's probably bad for their free agency, but something's got to change. I mean, Toronto hasn't gotten here. They never get here. The last time they were here, Vince Carter was in uniform. They have to do whatever it takes, whatever's best for the team. And right now, DeRozan playing – the amount of minutes he has, taking the amount of shots he has, isn't helping the team.
It's funny that you mentioned Casey just kind of riding and dying with his guys, because I think the Heat are kind of doing the same thing in respect of Dwayne Wade and Joe Johnson getting into the post. I mean, a lot of what the Heat have been doing is contested jumpers and contested fadeaways and turnarounds from the mid-post with both of those guys, and it kind of looks ugly. Like, this has not been a pretty series. But it's also Dwayne Wade and Joe Johnson. That's what they've been doing their entire career. They've gotten to 19 combined All-Star games doing that basically their entire career for the most part. That's kind of the shot that they want. And for the Raptors, you know, Kyle Lowry's going to be physical. He's going to try to get into the paint. DeRozan's going to take mid-range jumpers. Neither of these teams are, like, pretty offensively in the first place. I thought the defense in those first two games was underrated. I thought both teams played good defense for the most part. Whiteside had a couple of bad lapses at the end of game 2 in the pick and roll, unsure how to cover it between Lowry and Valanciunas. But other than that, I mean, people keep saying that this is an ugly series. I think it's just going to be ugly this whole series. I don't think this is going to get any prettier.
No, I don't think so either. And they are two good defensive teams. I mean, the Raptors trailed off at the end of the year, and the Heat turned it on a little bit more at the end of the year. But they're both good defensive teams. The turnovers for Miami are the big thing. And I don't know if you want to just credit sloppiness or the Raptors' defense or however you want to slice that up, but the turnovers have been big. And I think the Heat backcourt had, I think, 7 in the first quarter of last game, and the Raptors barely won. And I mean, I guess if you're the Heat, you can say DeRozan and Lowry shot 16-46, and they barely won. So, I mean, there's so much bad in this series that it's hard to imagine it going away. And that's the same thing with the Raptors shooting woes. If you're hoping that Lowry or DeRozan's going to turn it around, it's like it's been 9 games now they've played in the playoffs. So what's going to spark them. I mean, if that Lowry buzzer beater in game one was nuts,
right?
Absolutely nuts. I mean,
also
this team
out of
was.
Bounds.
Yeah, it was. It was. I mean, at the time, he hits this shot after he was, I think, 2 of 26 from 3-pointers in his last 5 games. He hits this massive three. They go into overtime. They come out flat as hell. The Heat get away with a win. They somehow come back. I just don't know what hasn't happened that could happen that's going to turn this Raptors team into another level. And I shouldn't say the team because there's a lot of guys playing hard, but to turn DeRozan and Lowry into what they were in the regular season, I just don't know what you could possibly expect to trigger that at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're Casey, you almost have to try to find a game plan, and much easier said than done, right? Find a game plan that doesn't really rely on Lowry and DeRozan, maybe getting Patrick Patterson more involved than he was. Valanciunas, just give him 16, 17 shots a game near the rim. Maybe start Corey Joseph. I don't know what it is. I mean, people talk about you can't bench Lowry and DeRozan because you'll shoot their confidence. I mean, that ship has sailed, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'm saying. If you want to ride and die one more game, you want to go into game three after a win and just hope they're going to turn it, fine. Give them one more game. But after that, it's dire. You're down 2-1. It's time to think about a big change. And I think Corey Joseph's earned it. Corey Joseph has been awesome through the
Fantastic.
First two rounds.
Yeah.
He's been so good. And back to where we were at the beginning. Lowry does other things. Lowry plays defense. He's amongst the league leaders in steals. His assist percentage is really good. So you keep him on the floor. Because when Joseph, Lowry, Patterson, and that group, Biombo, were playing in the regular season, their plus-minus was insane. DeRozan wasn't part of that group. And before, what he was doing in terms of creating opportunities for his teammates, attacking, it made it valuable to keep him out there. But he's not adding that value. And they really do need to consider maybe go Joseph, Lowry, and feed JV. Feed him. I mean, the Heat, you can say the same thing with the Heat and Whiteside sometimes, but JV has really worked his butt off this mm-hmm. postseason. He's rebounding like crazy. Half the touches he gets are off his own offensive rebounds. There's no reason not to give this guy a few more looks in the post, especially when he's shooting 60-something percent.
Yeah, and I think the Heat, it's kind of funny what you're talking about with the Raptors' perspective and what the Heat are kind of talking about from their perspective. It's a lot of the same stuff. Like, I imagine Raptors fans are wondering why Valanciunas only got 9 shots in Game 2. And Heat fans are wondering why Hassan Whiteside's only gotten 7 shots in each of Game 1 and Game 2. While that was kind of the matchup a lot of people were looking forward to, is Valanciunas versus Whiteside and how those two are going to play together, because they're so similar. They're both just very raw. They both just use their upper body. Like, they never use their lower body. Both they just kind of rely on general athleticism and brute strength to do things. And I just wanted to see more of those two going head-to-head. Yet both teams have kind of gone away just from that simple pick-and-roll with them that kind of was a lot of their bread and butter during the regular season on both sides. And I don't know. I find it's weird. So I think that the Heat, towards the end of that game, started to try to get Whiteside a little bit more involved. Like, he only had 7 shot attempts, but there was, like, that one Joe Johnson floater that was clearly a lob for Whiteside that he just completely missed. I think Dwayne Wade had something similar. It ended up hitting the rim, but I think it looked more like a pass for Whiteside. Like, so those 7 attempts don't really show how much they were actually trying to go at Whiteside. But, yeah, I think in general just both teams are kind of in the same spot. Like, they're both relying on mid-range jumpers. They could both probably use more pick-and-roll stuff with their big men. And both of their defense has been good, and both of them have been kind of messy. The Heat with turnovers, the Raptors with shooting. Like, it's kind of even. It doesn't surprise me that this thing is 1-1 going back to Miami. How big do you think it is that the Heat basically stole home court already in this series?
I honestly, and I mean, maybe this is why Heat Twitter hates me, but I don't think it matters at all. I mean, I don't think it matters even the slightest, because you haven't seen a boost. It's not like Toronto's got a boost when they've been at home. I mean, this is the same team with shot confidence, limping through these games, relying on their second unit in both series. And Toronto's one of their best games might have been Game 5 against Indiana, against the Air Canada Center, but they got wins on the road too. I mean, they won Game 3 they won in Indiana. If you're the Heat, you're happy about it, and you can be confident about it. But if you're the Raptors, you don't need to be upset about it. I guess
just that's because the way they basically play the same on the road and at home, the Raptors do.
Yeah, I mean, what changes? Like, is DeRozan way better at home? No. Is Lowry more comfortable with his hoops, his rims? It doesn't look like it. So, I mean, what's the negative?
I do think that the Heat have been substantially better at home. I think Whiteside in particular has been much better at home. So I think that might be what changes in the series. But for the Raptors, I agree with you. I haven't really seen much of a difference. They're a good road team. I mean, and it doesn't really matter if they're good or bad because, yeah, they're two all-stars, just can't do anything regardless of what arena they're playing in. But I do think that going back home with the Heat stealing a game on the road, I think that they looked a little bit content in game two to split the series. And they didn't come out with as much urgency as you may have hoped. But going back home with now home court advantage, I think is going to be a major thing for them. Just because I think all those guys play better at home.
We'll wait and see. I mean, I hear you, but in the same breath, what? Miami was up 2-0. They lost two on the road. They went home. They lost again, that's right?
True.
I mean,
yeah.
I just.
No, wait, no, that's not. I true. Think. Oh, wait, yeah, it is. I'm sorry. Yeah, they did lose two straight. Yeah.
Yeah, so they went. There's 2-2. They went back home. They lost, and then they dug in and won the next two, which is commendable. But I think people read too much into home and away, and I know there's stats that probably prove me wrong on this. But especially from a confidence factor, if you're DeMar DeRozan and you're Kyle Lowry, and everyone's talking about how terrible you've played to this point, which everyone is, do you feel more confident playing at home with the pressure of your own fans in front of you, or the Miami fans are going to boo you regardless, right? I almost think there's an argument to be made if it's mental, which to some extent I think we both agree it is, you might be better on the road. There's less pressure to perform on the road. People don't think you're going to win. People aren't rooting for you. You're not letting anyone down. I think there's something to be said for that as well.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, everybody thought that the pressure would be off after they got that first round series win, right? Because they finally won a series since like 1776. But there was that didn't seem to be the case. But again, they were playing back in front of their home crowd. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's just like, hey, we're down 1-1. We've already lost home court advantage. Let's just keep shooting. But to that same respect, that's kind of what they were doing. When DeMar DeRozan missed those free throws at the end of game two, they still won the game. But I mean, he's one of the best free throw shooters in the league. That was just surprising. And he just looked completely whacked out of his mind. Like, it's almost like I'm rooting for the Heat to win this thing. I'm unapologetically a Heat fan, but it's hard to watch because I like Lowry and DeRozan. Like, it's hard to watch those guys struggle so much. Like, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but if the Heat do win this series and DeMar DeRozan and Lowry never get going, what do you do in the offseason? Where do you go from here? Is Dwayne Casey's job still, you know, safe because he's finally won a playoff series? I mean, what's kind of is this about to explode if the Raptors lose this series? And by the way, if the Raptors lose this series, that's not necessarily an upset. This is a 3-2, you know, seeded series. I mean, this is both teams are evenly odded, like have even odds to win this thing. I just, what do you do if you're the Raptors in this offseason?
That's an interesting question, and it's crazy because when I put the poll out on Twitter, the Heat. People had the Heat winning by like a large percent. I think it was like 65% of people thought the Heat were going to win this series, but Vegas had Toronto winning. And it's like, it was. It's a 2-3. It's a close matchup. What's troubling about DeRozan isn't just that the playoff, maybe there's like a mental problem in the playoffs. You're running out of excuses to say, oh, he'll get better. I mean, he's 26 years old. He's been in the league, I want to say 7 years. Let me just double check that. Yeah, he's been in the league seven. This is season seven. He's 26. He hasn't been a great playoff performer. In round one, even after everything, people were trying to give him a pass because Paul George is such a terrific defender. But, I mean, Justice Winslow isn't, you know, draped over him. He isn't playing a ton of minutes. He's not getting smothered by anyone. So what is it? And do you want to invest a max contract in this guy? I don't know that from my perspective you do. I think Toronto keeps him. I can't see any way that they let him walk for free, sign him and maybe trade someone after that. But if you're Toronto, I think things are going to fall apart if you lose the series. And as great as it is, it's the first time since 2001 that they've got to the second round. Something's got to change if it doesn't work. And there was this undertone. I mean, despite setting the franchise record in wins the last 3 years, there's always this, like, if things go bad, Casey could go. And you should feel more excited than we do in Canada about the second round appearance, but we don't. And I think part of that's Casey, and he's the easy casualty, right? He's the easy scapegoat if things don't work.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's been a strange way that they got to that second round. I mean, Lowry and DeMar DeRozan, like I said, it's just so depressing to watch them. They're generally liked players in the league. And I just, they kind of eked it out against Indiana somehow. Still not sure how they won that series. I don't know. I thought Casey made some good moves with the Patrick Patterson adjustment, with going more with Powell. Just some of the little things that he did I thought were good. Like I said, I think his downshifting to the small ball unit kind of played into Miami's favor. I think Miami, when they see that, they're much more relaxed. Like, it'll be interesting to see how much more Patterson gets involved, because I think he's kind of the X factor right now for the Raptors. I think you're right though. It's always kind of, the onus has been on Casey, so I think he's the easiest scapegoat if things go wrong.
The problem with the Raptors too is they are always relying on an X factor. Like, your X factor is supposed to be like, this guy puts you over the top. Like, Patrick Patterson, Corey Joseph, whoever it is. Like, what they're bringing to you off the bench, or what they're bringing to you above what they normally do, is supposed to be that over the top feature, and it isn't. It's what's keeping them alive. And you can't keep hoping your X factors carry the whole load while your franchise players don't. We're kind of getting repetitive here, but that's the problem. It just, last year was similar too, where like Amir Johnson was at times their best playoff performer, and you're like, that's great that Amir Johnson is kicking butt and taking names, but do you really want Amir Johnson to be your best player in a playoff game? No, you don't.
I wonder if they can go ahead and sign Paul Pierce now that the Clippers are out of it, and just put him on the bench, and if anybody can overcome this mental stuff, I think Paul Pierce could snap his guys out of it.
Yes.
They don't really have a veteran like that on the roster. I mean, they have Scola, Luis Scola, who's like, everything you read is just like one of the most beloved teammates in the NBA, but he's not necessarily the fiery guy that, like, I don't know, like the Heat have Udonis Haslem, Chris Bosh, you know, Amari Stoudemire, a lot of vets that have been there, Dwayne Wade, obviously, who had that kind of rousing speech before the game won overtime on the sidelines. Maybe it's the Raptors don't really have that veteran. I don't know. I don't know how much that comes into play, really. I know that the Heat rely on their vets and their big locker room guys to kind of galvanize the team. I don't know if the Raptors kind of have a guy like that.
No, absolutely. And let me tell you, as a Canadian who watched Luis Scola absolutely torch your national team, and I mean torch, like he looked like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar out there on the floor in the tournament this summer, and then to come onto the Raptors and kind of be a handicap, everyone wants him out of the rotation. It's pretty depressing. I mean, he's a different guy in international ball than he is in the NBA for sure. Not taking away what he is in the locker room or as a teammate, but he hasn't been productive for the Raptors. I wanted to talk actually a little bit about Wade, because, you know, I've been hard on the guy and critical of the guy due to his age and injuries, but I got to say, honestly, in game one, the game was ugly too. I mean, I don't think anyone was calling it an instant classic, but the way Wade closed down that game was masterful. And I mean, that is one of the best playoff finishes I've ever seen from Wade, like ever. And I'm like, as I said, as a Dallas fan, I watched every game of the 06 finals, where, like, we could talk about that too, but like, it's different to get to the line and knock down free throws and run crazy like he did in the 06 finals. But that first game against the Raptors, I mean, he was hitting the floor. He got back-to-back blocks. He grabbed the steal. He had that. He turned his back on the free throw line, hit that shot, found Dragic for the three. I mean, Wade did absolutely everything in the final 5 minutes of that fourth quarter. It was really something. And I tried to give him credit on Twitter, but, like, wow. I was absolutely blown away with how great he was down the stretch of game one.
I agree with you. Wade's been absolutely fantastic in the playoffs with just the way he's been, you know, controlling and directing the pick and roll and just everything. It's funny because he had that stretch in the 06 playoffs and the 06 finals that were just amazing and everything like that. But then it's kind of cool. And then obviously the big three era where he was kind of, Robin to LeBron's Batman and everything like that. And now to see him kind of have the center stage again and just everything be on him, and the final shot goes to him now, and for him to hit those threes in Charlotte and to hit that three at the end of game two against the Raptors, and to do everything at the end of game one, like you were just talking about, it's really cool. I know, for Heat fans, and I think a lot of people forgot that he could do this nationally. And he's right back doing it. I mean, I was wondering this the other day, and I'm actually interested to see what you think. Wade's kind of occupying this strange space. He came into the league the same year as LeBron, but he's not quite, obviously he's not LeBron's level anymore. You obviously have the Westbrooks and Durants, the Kawhi Leonards, the Steph Currys and all that stuff. And then you have Kobe Bryant, right? Who had this bad year. He's basically semi-retired, but was still a living legend on the court. Like, Dwayne Wade's still a living legend on the court, I mean, how much, where, what space is he occupying in the NBA right now? Like, not necessarily where he ranks, but I'm not really sure what I'm asking. I guess I'll just let you do with the answer with whatever you want. But I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Well, I think I kind of know where you're going. And on the national scale, when the 2014 finals happened, Wade was horrid, and he was so bad in that series. And I think it hit people really hard because he'd been such a great finals performer in the past. And I mean, it was LeBron's team when Wade was there. I mean, he was Robin. If I say that, I'll get killed. When you say that, that's probably whatever. But he was this great player in the finals. Even 2011 when Dallas won, Wade was awesome. But just seeing him shrink on that stage and clearly not himself, I think there was a lot of doubt. And then, the Heat struggle in 2015. There's injuries all around. Wade's never been a great shooter. His athleticism's going. There was a lot of reasons, solid basketball reasons to be skeptical. But this is where being a veteran, staying in game shape matters. And you see it. I mean, like you said, Wade still tries to get into the post. He still muscles younger, bigger guys. He does what he does. He's not a great three-point shooter, but he finds other ways to get his offense. I don't think he should have been an all-star this year. His regular season wasn't anything crazy to write home about, but he did the important thing, which was stay healthy, stay in shape. He clearly feels all right in the playoffs. He's still, I think, a top 50 player in this league. I mean, do you draft him differently? Like when you're ranking him, you rank him higher for a playoffs, for a run in the playoffs, than you do for a regular season.
Completely agree. I like the way you phrase that. Completely agree.
Because this is what he was waiting for, right? And I mean, we talk about it with LeBron and the Cavs about how they coast through the regular season all the time and they don't really turn it on until playoffs. We didn't get the Heat in the playoffs last year, but I think that's similar with Wade, where they knew they were going to make the playoffs. They were a good team. They were, competing for that three seed at the end. But this Wade turned it on in the playoffs because this is what matters. And no one's going to write home about his regular season. He doesn't care. He's not going to win an MVP. He's probably not going to be All-NBA. But this is what matters, having some success away from LeBron, past LeBron, proving all the people wrong who counted him out a couple years ago. I mean, that's big stuff.
So, all right, we don't make predictions on the Heat Check podcast. well, David and I don't. But I guess there's really no rules against the guest making a prediction. Do you want to give a prediction for Game 3 and or the rest of the series? Oh. What did you pick before the series, by the way? Everybody kind of has their picks.
I didn't pick.
Yeah.
I didn't want to comment because I felt so unsure. I think the Raptors team that I saw in the regular season should have won the series in 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the team that I watched in the first round. That's not the team that I watched in the first two games. Honestly, I feel like the Heat are going to win the series. I do. I don't know about game three. I think the Heat are probably going to win in six. But, let's see. I mean, the silver lining, if you're a Toronto fan, is our all-star backcourt could not play any worse.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't play any worse. So if you get even 70% of what they give you in the regular season, it's a different series. But I just feel like the Heat have the upper hand right now. And like I said, it's not even the home court advantage. It's that Toronto doesn't have their head on straight, and the Heat have the veterans. The Heat have the guys who know how to dig in, who know how to win dirty playoff series, who are focused. I mean, you watched DeRozan at the free throw line last night when you're up. just to close it out. I mean, you're up. It's not a two-point game. It's not a one-possession game. It's a two-possession game. Just knocked down some free throws, and he choked, and it was brutal to watch. And then you watch Dwayne Wade in game one, who just down, it doesn't matter, face cold as ice. I mean, that I was intimidated. I think the Heat just have a better idea of what they're doing right now.
All right. Well, I like the sound of that. I think that the important thing is that this is a real, if you're either fan base, Raptors or Heat, it's really like, I think your personality depends on what you think of this series, because it's very half glass empty or you know, half empty, half full type thing for both. I mean, you can look at the Heat and be like, well, we have a stagnant offense and we're only hitting contested shots. Like, we're turning the ball over a ton. We didn't play well. We should have been up 2-0. And if you're an optimist, you can say for the Heat, look, we didn't play our best games and we're heading back to Miami with a series tied 1-1. We stole home court. And for the Raptors, I think it's right. Like, hey, our backcourt didn't play well, just like you're saying. We're tied 1-1. It could be way worse. We could be down 0-2 right now. I mean, there's a lot of ways to kind of shape and frame this series. And we could talk about any number of things and psychoanalyze and X's and O's analyze all this stuff. But what it comes down to is this is going to be an ugly series, but it's going to be fun for both fan bases. And I don't know. I'm looking forward to game three on Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, too, about the no predictions is good. And it was annoying the hell out of me the last day and a bit on Twitter, just seeing people talk like, oh, well, we this and we that. And the Heat fans are really confident. And the Toronto fans are really optimistic. I'm like, no one should be talking. No one should be claiming anything, because the games have been ugly and they could have gone either way. I mean, both went to overtime.
Right.
There's not a lot to stand on and say, well, this, we've been better because X. I mean, you're just filling in the blank with whatever makes you feel better. And that's not really great analysis.
All right. Well, I think that's it, Josh. Thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it, especially with all the technical difficulties that we had before trying to get this going.
Yeah, I don't know. Skype undermined us, but I'm glad it happened. Thanks for having me on.
Take that, Skype. That was Josh Eberle. You can find him at HoopMag, Today's Fast Break, Hoops Habit, B-Ball Breakdown, and Basketball Buzz. Also on Twitter. Really, really good follow on Twitter, at Josh Eberle. All right. Thanks, man.
Take care.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Heat Check podcast. We really appreciate it. That was a fun one with David and me in the first part, and then in the second part with me and Josh Eberle. Always a great talk. Just a few announcements about the show. Some exciting stuff. We just launched a Twitter account and a Facebook account. On Twitter, you can follow the show at The Heat Check Pod. And then on Facebook, just search on Facebook Heat Check Podcast or go to facebook.com/Heat Check Podcast to find the show's Facebook page. And on the Facebook page, we'll be doing some additional written content. Already you can see four things to watch for Heat Raptors Game 3. Just some exclusive content on the Facebook page that you'll find there. And on Twitter and on the Facebook page, we'll be opening up the mailbag on there for all of your questions that you want to throw at us. And basically you can leave it there at any point and we'll answer it on the next show that we do. So go ahead and follow us there. And then again on iTunes, please rate and review us. I mean, it helps the show drastically as far as showing up in iTunes searches when people are searching for a Miami Heat podcast, and just for, in general, our awareness. I mean, really, if we get enough ratings and reviews, we can land a spot on the iTunes top charts, maybe even on the front page. I mean, we have big aspirations for the show. So any of the loyal listeners that we have, any new listeners that we have, please go to iTunes and leave a review under the show page. We'd really appreciate it. We'll leave the link on the Facebook page and tweet something out too with instructions on how to do so if you don't know how to do it already. Anyway, that's it. Thanks for listening to the Heat Check podcast. It was a good one. And make sure to check out the rest of the Hardwood Proxies and Basketball Network on Blog Talk Radio. And we'll catch you next time.
10 bands, 50 bands, 100 bands, fuck it, man. Let's just not even discuss it, man. OMG, nigga sleep. I ain't tripping, I'ma let him sleep. I ain't tripping, let him rest in peace. I could tell you how it happened. I could tell you about them safe house nights out in Calabasas. I could tell you not a rap. Trying to set a story, I don't even open up the package. Who you with? What you claim?